My guest today is author and therapist Linda Graham. She has experience like psychotherapist, but she also integrates modern neuroscience, mindfulness, and relational psychology in her trainings on resilience and well-being. She's the author of several books, including Bouncing Back and her new book, Resilience. And I have to say that when a new Linda Graham book comes out, I pre-order it immediately because I know it's going to be fantastic. She has such a focus on practices and tools you can use to shift yourself. And also, she is science-based. I love the fact that her work is grounded in solid science. So she isn't just giving you good ideas she thinks will work. She's giving you tools that are shown by experiments published in peer-reviewed journals to work. And so you can know with confidence using her methods that they're effective. Her website is lindagraham-mft.net. I'll just spell it out for you to make sure you can get there. It's Linda, her first name, L-I-N-D-A, Linda Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M, -mft.net. And again, her newest book is called Resilience, and I highly recommend the book. I grabbed the book, I opened the wrapper the moment it arrived, and quickly looked through it. I wanted to see what new things she had in store for me, and I was not disappointed. Linda, it's wonderful to have you here on the show.
Oh, thank you, Dawson. It's really an honor to be with you. Thank you.
So we haven't met in person, as I have with so many of my authors, but I've been aware of your work through your books and recommended it to people, and I can't imagine a more timely book than your new book, Resilience. The subtitle is Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, and Even Disaster. And I'm just so touched by your tone, by the way you connect with people, and the gifts you bring in your books. How did you come to this passion for sharing and helping people?
Well, I've been a psychotherapist for a very, very long time. And most people are coming in because their resilience has been thrown for some reason or another, and they're having trouble getting back to their own center or their own strengths, their own competencies, their own navigating the world. And so as I began to learn what's helpful to people, and especially learning some of the neuroscience of how we can actually choose the experiences that will rewire our brain so that we can be more resilient, I began to see people honestly not only doing better in their lives, but feeling better about themselves, trusting themselves more as someone who could be resilient, competent, and move into well-being and thriving and flourishing. So the passion comes from seeing it working.
And so people are coming in and they're initially coming to you because they're dealing with some challenge in their lives, and it sounds like maybe initially they don't necessarily believe they can change and become resilient, but they discover their strengths and their resources in the course of therapy.
Yes, that's true, and what we're learning about resilience is there are different elements to resilience. One is the severity of the external stressors. So people will be coming in if they've lost a job or they've lost a relationship or they've lost their home. What the stressor is does make a difference. But there's also the strength of our external resources. Can we turn to family and friends? Do we have financial resources and medical resources? But the third element is one's own internal resources. Do we have the grit, the determination, the perseverance, the heart, the response flexibility to be able to deal with whatever those challenges are? And people are coming in to therapy to work on whatever disaster or disappointment they're facing in their life because they've lost touch with their own strengths, or they've lost touch with how to use those strengths in a skillful way. So I'm really helping people get back in touch again with their own capacities for resilience, because they're innate in our being. They're innate in our brain. We're hardwired to be able to be resilient. And helping people get back in touch, mostly by choosing to use the experiences that will actually help them strengthen their capacities of response flexibility. So that's where the practical, evidence-based aspect comes in, we know that these tools can actually work to calm down the nervous system, to manage these powerful surges of emotions, to get back in touch with your own inner secure base of resilience, to reach out to people in other ways that are effective, and to be reflective, to notice, to pay attention, to be able to discern the wisest thing to do next.
Yes, which of course often you can't do when in the middle of a crisis. I'm just curious about you saying that capacities for resilience are hardwired into our brains. Do you know which brain regions are important in resilience?
Well, what we found is it's the higher brain, the prefrontal cortex, which everyone knows is the center of executive functioning. That's what it's known for, where we can make decisions and make judgments and make plans. But the prefrontal cortex actually does many, many things. It regulates the nervous system. It regulates our fight, flight, freeze, survival responses. It regulates our emotions so that we can come back to an emotional equilibrium. It's what allows us to tune into our own experience, tune into other people's experience. It's what allows us to have a sense of self that evolves as we move through time. And it is the structure of response flexibility. It's what allows us to shift gears, to shift our perspectives, to actually respond to experience in a way different from what we've done before. So I call it the CEO of resilience. And when we can learn how to increase that capacity for response flexibility, we're going to be more resilient.
Yeah, I've been reading recently about structures of the prefrontal cortex, like the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which links directly to the limbic system, and some brain scientists have said should actually be considered part of the limbic system, but actually has that direct link straight from the prefrontal cortex into our emotional regulation centers, and when that's active, when that ventromedial prefrontal cortex is active, it's literally able to calm us and regulate the emotional parts of our responses. And so how, you mentioned many different kinds of stressors that people can experience, and of course some people might handle one kind of stressor well. They might be resilient when it comes to money or to relationships, but then really not be resilient when it comes to health and need a lot of help and support when it comes to that area of their lives, and that brings people in. If we just were to walk through the first part of what you might do with a new client, so say someone's come to you and they've really been thrown by some one of those crises in their lives, where do you start?
Well, I'm listening, of course, to whatever the crisis is. I'm listening to how well they're coping or not coping. And I really listen for something they are doing that is skillful, that is working. It may not be the whole story at the time. It may be 5% of what they're experiencing. But I'm looking for some positive strength that we can begin to pull on and use as a resource to deal with all the other places that aren't working so well. So I'm really listening for any capacities that they already have. When people are stressed out, the first thing is to help them get their nervous system back into its natural baseline, physiological equilibrium, what we call the range of resilience, so that their higher brain can stay online, so that they can see what they're doing and choose how they want to respond to what's happening. So many, many tools of our somatic intelligence, and that is often where I start with a client, tools with thought, of breath, of touch, of movement, a visualization to help them actually calm down the nervous system so that it's in that range of resilience. That's where I would start, so that they can even be present to their experience without either getting too agitated or shutting down.
I love that about the book, because you have several domains of resilience in the book, but your very first one in Chapter 2 is somatic experience. And the reason I'm so grateful for that is that I've just gained so much insight from therapy, and I believe that cognitive therapies and talk therapies can be incredibly effective, but for traumatized people, as we discovered in research in the 1980s and 1990s, talking about the problem often re-traumatizes them, and you've got to make them safe in their body first before you can bring in those cognitive tools. And so I just so appreciate that the very first part of the book, you're talking about the whole idea of getting, staying in the body. All of those things are bringing you breath, touch, movement. All of those things are bringing you back into your body.
Right, and the brain will learn and grow and change the best when the brain feels safe, when the brain itself is not in trauma. So I work quickly to help people feel safe in their body, feel safe in the relationship with me, and feel safe in relationship to themselves. Because very often, in addition to whatever trauma or difficulty people are having to cope with, they're having to cope with very negative messages, negative self-talk. They're jumping all over themselves for how badly they're coping. And so I also need to help people come into a safer relationship with themselves, believing in themselves, believing in the process. I find many clients and students in my workshops actually get very excited when they begin to learn how the brain works, because it gives them a sense of competence and mastery, and then they're ready to experiment, to explore, to try new things that might work better. So that safety is absolutely key.
Yeah, and of course, Abraham Maslow wisely put safety and security, survival, at the bottom of the hierarchy of needs, because you can't go and do all those other wonderful things if you're dead. So safety and security
right.
is the foundation of the hierarchy of needs. Everything else up through self-actualization comes about that, and people mm-hmm. have to know that. And I think they have to know that not at an intellectual level. Like you can say intellectually, oh, I'm safe. I see I'm safe, but they have to feel that at the level of the body. I remember I was once with a young psychiatrist from Walter Reed, and we were in the Cannon House office building in Washington, D.C., and this young psychiatrist had served several tours of duty in Iraq in 2004, 2005, and we were sitting in this office building waiting to see someone from a government institution. And he was laughing and joking. We were just kind of chatting, shooting the breeze while waiting for our appointment with a member of Congress. And he said to me, Jules, you didn't realize this, but even though I'm sitting here and I look relaxed, I'm sitting with my back to the wall. I'm looking at every person who walks by to see if there are any bulky protuberances under their clothes where they might be concealing an explosive vest. And I'm looking out for that all the time. And, mm-hmm. you know, Linda, I was staggered. I had no idea he was doing this. He was hypervigilant, even literally in probably the most secure building on the face of the planet, the House mm-hmm. office building in Washington, D.C., and he was sitting with his back to the wall looking for explosive vests inside the building. It's just extraordinary that you know, intellectually you can say I'm safe, and that psychiatrist was brilliant. He knew that, but his body sure didn't feel that way.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting into some very interesting territory here, Dawson. Interesting that you were there with him, hearing his story, because Matthew Lieberman at UCLA has written his book, Social, and sort of revised Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yes, safety and survival is key, but we survive because we are connected and linked with other people, especially when we're very, very young. And so he's placing connection at the base of our hierarchy of needs, that we need to be connected with other people in order to feel safe, in order to be safe. And now this is, of course, expanded by the work of Stephen Porges and his social engagement system. Our nervous system is regulated by other nervous systems. And when we can turn to someone, as this man turned to you, and talk about safety, when we can turn to another person and see in their facial expressions, in their body language, in their tone of voice, that they are safe, we are safe, we can begin to feel that sense of safety in our own nervous system again. So connection is really feeling safe. In connection is also a very, very basic human need, and very often people don't develop that sense of resilience if they have not felt safe in their world with their caregivers early on. If there's been too much trauma in childhood, it's really hard for people to develop that sense of resilience. So I also, I mean, in the book, as you know, I talk about somatic body-based intelligence and emotional intelligence, because we do have to be able to regulate our negative emotions and use positive emotions to cultivate a sense of well-being. But relational intelligence is also really important, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to other people. Do we feel safe? Can we use other people as a refuge and as a resource when we're going through a hard time? So that's also in there, is the importance of connection.
Could you just share the case of a client who learned or relearned this in the course of their therapy?
So, well, if I can, I'll do it this way. One of the first tools that I teach people is hand on the heart, because that will calm down the nervous system pretty immediately. But that involves putting your hand on your heart, breathing deeply, breathing in a sense of safety and goodness, and then remembering a moment, remembering just one moment when you felt safe or loved or cherished with another human being. Now, that may be with me in the therapy room, but it could be with a partner or with a child or with a good friend. It could be a spiritual figure. It could be a pet. When people can evoke a memory of feeling safe, they can evoke the felt sense of it in their body. So they're actually activating the release of oxytocin, which is the brain hormone of safety and trust. It's the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So as soon as we evoke the oxytocin from a sense of feeling safe and connected, heart rate goes down, the blood pressure goes down, we come into that sense of ease and well-being in our body again. So that's often one of the first things that I will teach my clients, because that's portable equilibrium. They can do that as they go throughout their day. And when they experience the efficacy of it, they're more likely to believe that they can become resilient. That tool is powerful enough to calm down a panic attack.
I love that idea of portable resilience. You take it with you. You need that, because when you're having that panic attack, you aren't with your therapist. You need a tool you can use right there on the spot. So, Linda, you talked about the importance of those connections, and that obviously, as human beings, if we weren't connected to somebody early in our lives, we die. So connection is essential for us as a foundation of survival. You then start to focus on emotional intelligence and relational intelligence. Go ahead and share some of the points you make in the book, and also about some of the clients you've had who've applied these techniques and they made a difference.
Okay. So actually, I'm very happy to talk about emotional intelligence, because very often people have a difficult time with strong, powerful feelings, and those could be what we call negative feelings of anger or fear or sadness, but they could also sometimes even be of positive feelings, like a lot of joy or a lot of delight. So I teach tools both to manage negative emotions and then to increase our positive emotions. The reason to increase the positive emotions is, as you just mentioned, when people are more optimistic, they have a lifespan of probably on the average 8 years longer. So some of the studies that have been done on positive emotions, cultivating a sense of gratitude or compassion or kindness or joy or awe or delight, anytime we cultivate those positive emotions, that leads to more optimism. It does lead to a longer lifespan, as you mentioned, and it leads to resilience. The direct and measurable cause and effect outcome is resilience, and that's because when we're practicing a positive emotion like gratitude, we're shifting the functioning of the brain from reactivity and contraction and negativity back out to a more open, receptive, positive mental state where we can become more optimistic, we can become more resilient. So an example I have of doing that with a client is, I had a client who came in very, very negative, lots of complaints, lots of woe is me. And it was actually difficult to sit with. So partly because it works, but partly in self-defense, I suggested that we do a 5-minute gratitude free write at the beginning of every session, just sitting there quietly, each of us together, writing down the things that we were grateful for. We actually never shared the list, but it's just that his mood shifted, and then we could have a more positive, more productive therapy session. So even in those few minutes, the gratitude practice was having a beneficial effect. But it does make us more resilient. It does help us live longer. It's a way to decrease depression, anxiety, loneliness, and stress. In terms of the negative emotions, whenever we're feeling startled, we're feeling resentful, we're feeling upset, frightened, angry, disgusted, whatever those positive, those very, very difficult negative emotions are, I now teach my clients the protocol of mindful self-compassion, because it's the most powerful thing I've come up with to deal with these negative emotions. It was developed by Kristen Neff at University of Texas, Austin, and Chris Gurmer at Harvard. And the tool that I teach first is simply the self-compassion break. When you notice that you're upset about something, hand to the heart, ouch, this hurts, this is hard, I don't like this, this is painful. Just mindfully acknowledging, I'm having a hard time here. And then beginning the phrases, may I be kind to myself. And this is what can immediately antidote the negative self-talk that we can get into. May I be kind to myself. May I accept this moment exactly as it is, which is one of the most significant predictors we have of dealing with trauma. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment, which is the turning point of this practice. And then may I give myself all the compassion that I need. So when I have a client, I have a client that I've worked with for a few months now. Her name is Mary. And she has a lot of negative self-talk. Anytime she tries something, oh, I didn't do that right. I mean, even if it worked, I could have done that better. And so a lot of self-criticism. And I will teach her to interrupt that. May I be kind to myself. Even though I forgot the checkbook again, may I be kind to myself, may I accept myself exactly as I am, so that we're really leveraging in there when the negative things come up, not to make them go away. We don't practice mindful self-compassion to feel better, but we do practice it so that we'll do better. And so as this client, Mary, begins to do her phrases, oh, I guess I'm not such a bad human being after all. I guess that wasn't such a terrible mistake after all. It actually can shift her out of the negativity. So being able to work with our emotions skillfully is really, really important. You mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy earlier. It is effective when we are able to use positive thoughts to change negative thoughts. But sometimes we have to be able to use positive movement to change negative movement, or positive emotions to change negative emotions. We're working at all levels of the body.
Physical regulation, then we can bring in those shifts in consciousness and make them stick. So, Linda, one of the things that's puzzled me is, in fact, in our EFT workshops, I do an exercise on this. It's called disproportionate responses. There's some people who respond as though it was an earthquake when a small thing happens. I remember one female professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and she had 4 advanced degrees, and yet she'd lose her car keys often more than once a day, and she would storm through her house screaming and yelling and demanding that anyone in earshot help her find them. And she would be responding to this minor annoyance as though it were like time to call off the National Guard. You know, why do some people have these disproportionate responses to innocuous stimuli?
So it's a good question. And not only do some people respond disproportionately compared to other people, but sometimes we can respond disproportionately at a certain time in our life different from another time in our life, or different from another set of circumstances. So I really look at resilience as being foundational. It's a key capacity to have to meet any level of disruption. And that could be barely a wobble. You leave your car keys somewhere and you can't find them. And then 2 minutes later, you find them and hopefully you can rewrite yourself again. To the more serious difficulties, if you lose a job or lose your resilience, to the very, very serious traumas. And sometimes too much can happen all at once. You know, you get a diagnosis of lung cancer and you have to put an aging parent into a nursing home, and a pipe bursts in the kitchen and the kitchen floods, and it's just too much all at once. And that's what happens when people are facing the natural disasters that we're seeing around the world these days with climate change, whether that's earthquake, hurricane, wildfires, snowstorms. People can go into a kind of existential anxiety when they have to face a big disaster like that. So the way I teach building resilience is little and often, because that's how the brain learns the best. Small experiences repeated many times, so that you, perhaps this professor practices about her car keys, putting her car keys down, walking away, where are they? Oh, I'm starting to go into my panic, hand in my heart, breathing to calm down my nervous system. Oh, yes, there they are on the kitchen counter. Little and often, so that we build these capacities bit by bit over time. Then when the really big catastrophes show up, we're more ready for that. And if I could tell a personal story that might illustrate that.
Yes.
So I do a lot of teaching, and last winter I was teaching again at the Sivananda Ashram Yoga Center in the Bahamas. And so I fly across country. I fly to the Bahamas. It's late at night. It's dark. I'm tired. And I'm supposed to step from the dock to the boat to go to the island, and I miss the boat. So I jump right into the Caribbean, and I grab the boat. I come up. I'm alive. They pull me into the boat. And then I realize my backpack was on my back, and my computer was in my backpack. So you know that the computer is fritzed, and my cell phone as well. And then I remembered, because it was happening about the time we were having the wildfires in Northern California, Linda, this is just your computer. It's just your data. You know, you're alive. You get to deal with this. And because I was teaching for 4 days at the ashram, I had a chance to watch all the tools of resilience show up as I went through those 4 days. Gratitude that I was alive. The self-compassion, it's okay, you're a human being, you're doing the best you can. Relying on other people. People were so, I'm in an ashram. People were so supportive and helpful and compassionate toward what I was going through. Reflecting, noticing when I would start to tip into the self-criticism, pulling myself back out, using all the tools I had. What happened was I realized, oh, these tools work. They show up when you need them. I am being more resilient than I would have been a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So I tell that story, not that, you know, jumping into the ocean with your computer is the worst thing that ever happens to people, but it's a chance to observe the tools of resilience coming into action. So the woman who has trouble when she loses her car keys, being able for her to see moments when she is resilient, moments when she is coping, and taking those little moments and building on them. That's what's important.
So building on those moments, yeah. Yeah, the biggest one for me in the last couple of years was that my wife and I were awakened in the middle of the night a year ago, and we had to literally run from our house just steps ahead of the Tubbs Lane fire, and we sprinted to our car, jumped in, and drove out through the flames, and we eventually wound up a long way away and stayed with friends for a while, and just then having to deal with our home and our office being burned down, because we had a huge property. But the amazing thing was that when we were as disoriented as any kind of other people, you know, after the fire, and when the photographs came through a day or two later showing just rubble there. But then we began to do things to correct ourselves, and it was so powerful. Within 2 or 3 days, we were meditating, we were tapping, we were releasing, and we were moving into that feeling of empowerment. I then flew off to do a keynote speech and teach a trauma conference training therapists, and that was a lot of fun. I had these hundreds of eyeballs looking at me from the audience, looking at me and looking as like 5 days after the fire, and you see all these therapists thinking, is this guy really not traumatized? They were diagnosing me from the audience. But anyway, I knew I was you know resilient when I sent an email 2 or 3 days later to the woman who runs our organization, and the office had burned down. Everyone was just scrambling. The members had been evacuated, and I sent her an email. I said, Heather, you know our goal now for years has been to have a paperless office. I think we've just achieved our goal. No more paper. We were just joking about all the stuff we'd lost, we didn't really care about. So, Linda, you also cover a topic near and dear to my heart, which is post-traumatic growth. And I just feel it's such an underappreciated part of the whole picture. I was sharing with you during the break how the local paper ran a special issue on the fire, on the anniversary of the fire a year later, with all these stories about people who lost their homes, like my wife and I did, and all of the tragedies that they've gone through. And nowhere in that whole special issue, like 40 pages long, was there any mention of post-traumatic growth, about how you can actually use these experiences to propel your self-transformation. So please go ahead and share your five steps of post-traumatic growth, as well as an example of a client who used those successfully.
Mm-hmm. So we really owe a great deal to the pioneering research of Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun for initiating this whole field called post-traumatic growth and understanding the steps that people can go through to come out the other side of a trauma. And the way I talk about those steps, the first is acceptance of reality, simply accepting this happened. And William James, who's the founder of American Psychology, says, acceptance of what has happened is the first step in overcoming the consequences of any misfortune. So that acceptance is one of the significant predictors of whether people will come out the other side of a trauma into growth. And the second step is resourcing with people, just being with other people who understand what you've been through. You don't have to explain and justify. You just get to be with people and who believe in the process of recovery, people who will be a compassionate companion and allow you to go with your own experiences at your own pace. There's no need to fix you or anything like that. But we get resourced with other people who can appreciate our story and appreciate our efforts to cope. And that's why support groups are so very, very helpful when there's been a trauma. And then it's counterintuitive, but it's really important to resource with the positive, even in the midst of a tragedy, because the positive is what gives us a little breathing room. A moment of laughter with a friend gives us a little respite from the overwhelm of the trauma, and it's important to have that breathing space in our recovery. And then, of course, finding the silver lining, finding the lessons learned, finding the gift and the mistake, something that will redeem the event that has happened, what neuroscience writer Joan O'Leary calls turning a regrettable moment into a teachable moment. And so when we can find some good that comes out of the bad, even if it's just, well, this is what I could have done differently afterwards. And that all leads to what's called a coherent narrative. It's putting the story of the trauma into a written form. This is what happened. This is how I coped at the time. These are my resources at the time. This is how I would cope now, because sometimes we've learned new resources since then. This is the meaning that I found, and not, these are the lessons I learned, but this is the meaning that I found, not in spite of what happened, but because of what happened. And that's considered the hallmark of people really moving into post-traumatic growth. So it sounds like what you and your wife experienced when you lost your home in the Sonoma fires, and then say, oh, well, we always wanted a paperless office. I mean, that is an example of coping with the through these five steps, coming out the other side, standing on your own 2 feet, and knowing that you are, knowing that you are.
You know, one of the other questions I have about this is I do a lot of trauma training, and I for therapists, and I also work with people on stage at those trainings, and they recover from events so terrible that even as they describe them, I'm having to just really work with myself just to hear the story. And Linda, I hate to mention this, I have a few people who don't recover. I know people who there is no core that find. There is no, you know, there is no self there. There is no solid ground underneath all of the devastation in their psyches. And I'm at a bit of a loss. I mean, very few, very, very, very few, maybe three in the course of training people for 15 years, but there are those people. Even in our Veteran Stress Project, we've done 8 randomized controlled trials, and 9 out of 10 veterans recover from their PTSD after 6 sessions, but 1 out of 10 doesn't recover. Why is that?
Well, I can, without knowing the people involved or the details involved, at this point, I'm assuming that even though we laud neuroplasticity. We laud the capacity of the brain to change lifelong. And we're looking at ways that the brain can change for the positive. But it's possible that the functioning of the brain can be compromised by trauma and that we actually lose brain functioning. So we no longer have the capacities in the brain that would allow us to be resilient and cope with the trauma. That's the devastation of early childhood trauma, that not only when people are exposed to violence or abuse or addiction, people not only don't learn to be resilient, but the brain itself is compromised in its capacity to learn those skills and learn those functions. So that would be my guess, that when people are not able to recover from trauma, there's been some impairment to the functioning of their brain, and why they can't.
Yeah, that's shown by the study showing that the people most likely to get PTSD in combat are those who have been traumatized as children. Linda, we've got to have you back to go for more on the subject, maybe a whole show on post-traumatic growth. I so appreciate this. I so appreciate your passion. I so appreciate the practical tools you give people in your new book, Resilience. I'm so grateful to you for who you are and what you're sharing with everyone.
Thank you, Dawson, for those kind words. It means a lot coming from someone that does all the good in the world that you do. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Every blessing again. Linda's new book is Resilience, Powerful Practices of Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, Even Disaster, and her website is lindagraham-mft.net.